Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Well, that was some State of the Union address, wasn't it? It was good TV, for one thing. Biden was feisty, high energy, and sometimes playful. And politically, that tone was no accident, right? And so much of the point, like, hey, America, I am not too old and slow to run for re-election. Thank you. He said the words, let's finish the job, or finish the job, 12 times, I counted in the transcript, after noticing that it seemed to come up a lot as I was watching the speech. He practically announced his re-election bid right there. And the Republicans were feisty too, as everybody's talking about. Democrat Jamie Raskin, have you heard this, recently said of Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene that when she's at an official thing, like where there's supposed to be a certain decorum, it's like she's at the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Rocky Horror, for those of you who don't know, is a movie where the audience talks back at the screen. So we've pulled a number of clips, both of Biden and the Republican respondent, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the governor of Arkansas. We'll have two guests, and listeners, our phones are open for your reactions to anything from State of the Union night, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. And I want to start in a different place than I think most reaction shows are starting. I want to start with a contrast between how Biden and Huckabee Sanders spoke about health care and having cancer. And we're going to play Huckabee Sanders first. You'll hear that she starts with a knock on Democrats for wanting government to control things and then segues into her cancer story.
Democrats want to rule us with more government control, but that's not who we are. America is the greatest country the world has ever known, because we're the freest country the world has ever known, with a people who are strong and resilient. 5 months ago, I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. It was a hard time for our family, particularly our kids, Scarlett, Huck, and George. But we kept our faith and persevered. Thanks to exceptional doctors here in Arkansas, a successful surgery, and the grace of God, I am cancer-free.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders, it was good doctors and faith in God, the grace of God, that cured her cancer. Nothing about how she or other Americans pay for all that treatment. By contrast, Biden emphasized the health care costs that Americans face and a law he got passed with Democrat votes only and zero Republican votes to address it.
This law also caps and won't even go into effect until 2025, costs, out-of-pocket drug costs for seniors on Medicare at a maximum of $2,000 a year. You don't have to pay more than $2,000 a year, no matter how much your drug costs are. Because you know why? You all know it. Many of you, like many in my family, have cancer. You know the drugs can range from $10,000, $11,000, $14,000, $15,000 for the cancer drugs. If drug prices rise faster than inflation, drug companies are going to have to pay Medicare back the difference.
Biden from the State of the Union on health care. And from Sarah Huckabee's language, it seems like that was part of the government control of our lives that she was against in her response. We have many more clips to play as we welcome our guests for this reaction segment. Andrew Seligson, president of Public Agenda, a nonpartisan research and public engagement organization that emphasizes what they call hidden common ground, that is, seeking to highlight areas in which there is agreement across party lines that people may not realize exists. He was previously associate chancellor for civic engagement and strategic planning at Rutgers University Camden and director of civic engagement learning in the Pace Center at Princeton. And Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large at the 19th, the news organization covering the intersection of women, politics, and policy, named after the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, and it's the 19th with an asterisk because in practice, the amendment passed during Jim Crow excluded black women from the right to vote. Erin was previously a national writer on race for the Associated Press. She's also worked at the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post. So, Erin, welcome back. Always good to have you. And Andrew Seligson, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian, it's good to be with you.
And listeners, we'll get your reactions to anything from the State of the Union night as we go. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Erin, can I get your take on the contrast between those two clips on how they talked about cancer and the family and how it relates to their party's approaches?
Yeah, I mean, Brian, I think a lot of your observations I tend to agree with. Also, you know, I think the president in really highlighting the story of that couple who was in the gallery, a guest of the first lady who had a daughter who had was able to survive and beat cancer, really kind of putting their story on display, a story that probably also resonated with many Americans across the country, felt particularly powerful. Again and again, you know, using examples of real Americans and talking about them to let them know that he really sees them and that cancer, fighting cancer, is some of the work left undone, right? The less finished the job theme. He certainly puts cancer in that category of the work that they can collectively do as Americans and that he is committed to doing as president. Whereas, you know, Governor Huckabee Sanders clearly, you know, felt that government really didn't have a role in helping Americans to deal with this disease that has taken so many people in this country and around the world. So that was definitely a very sharp contrast between those two speeches.
Andrew, anything on that before we set up a next clip? I know you're interested in common ground, and the polls I've seen show concern about health care costs as way up there among Americans of both parties.
Yeah, I think one of the frustrations Democrats often have is that if you understand kind of how a lot of issues are actually structured, the role that government plays, people are pretty supportive of things that it turns out are related to government policy. But very frequently, the public doesn't know how those things are connected. And so it makes sense to people that it's the doctor and whatever else you believe might drive these things that is behind it, without recognizing the role government policy either may be playing in helping you or in some cases standing in the way of something, and it's about eliminating a barrier. So I think, you know, one of the things that I think Biden is good at rhetorically, he certainly has some challenges, is kind of humanizing the way that government works in people's lives. And I think for him, given, you know, his agenda, and as you said, his clear interest in running for re-election, trying to draw some of those connections is quite important, because exactly as Governor Huckabee Sanders showed, there's an interest in on the other side in painting government as always part of the problem, you know, which has been obviously a kind of part of the Republican playbook, at least since Ronald Reagan made that approach quite famous.
Looks like the Bronx is in the house wanting to react to State of the Union night. We're getting a few calls from the Bronx first up. So let's hear from Kenny in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hi, Kenny.
Hey, Brian. The Bronx always loves you. I was listening to your coverage last night with Kai Wright, and you were asking everyone for their opinion of the state. And, you know, for me, it was the state of chaos because of all the stuff that's been happening from the pandemic on and Trump and everything.
But so now, your answer to the State of the Union is the State of the Union is in a state of chaos.
No, that was yesterday. And today, upon hearing the president, I'm assured. And the fact that he not only because he shouted down the Republicans heckling him, but the fact that he was basically in command. He actually has done legislative stuff, and he's doing his thing, and he was confident, and he's trying to make he's trying to, even though there's only a four Republican majority, he's working with them, and he's trying to talk to them. So the fact that he's doing what he's doing, he's actually has legislative accomplishments, he's bringing monies to New York, that's the most important thing.
Kenny, thank you very much. And interesting that Kenny there, and we're going to talk about this with our guests as we go, points up both bringing it to the Republicans and talking about bipartisan things. Steve in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I actually saw President Biden 11 years ago at a convention, and he was just like he was last night, feisty, strong, shouting when he needs to be, and he was just at the top of his form. And I think he should take a leaf from Harry Truman's playbook, as he already has been doing. A year and a half from now, right in the middle of the campaign, if nothing has been passed, he should call a special session of the Congress and just lay it on the line, up and down on these issues. And he's great. I think he was superb last night.
Two big Biden fans in the Bronx. And you told our screener, happy warrior. I think you used that phrase, right?
That's right. He's a happy warrior. God bless him. He's an old pro.
Thank you, Stephen. Here's what we might characterize as one of those happy warrior moments, a good TV and playful moment from Biden right at the start. And Andrew, this will be for you first after the clip with your interest in bipartisanship. Practically the first words out of Biden's mouth as he acknowledges the new Republican Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, sitting behind him.
You know, I start tonight by congratulating the 118th Congress and the new Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. Speaker, I don't want to ruin your reputation, but I look forward to working with you.
Well, he had the Republicans cheering there before he even got the Democrats cheering. And Andrew, was that an olive branch, a way to disarm McCarthy, or some of both? You told us before the speech that one of the three big things you'd be watching for was how much Biden would reach for common ground versus sharpen distinctions between himself and the Republicans. So how did you see that moment on that scale?
Well, one of the things that stood out to me about the whole speech in that moment was a really good example of it, is that I think Biden is a little bit seeking to have it both ways, in that I think he's interested in sharpening the divisions on policy issues, but projecting a sort of common ground style in the way he engages, the way he interacts, the way he talks about his opponents. And so I think on a number of policy issues, he kind of laid down a stance that he knew was not at all popular with and not going to be embraced by the Republicans in the room, but that he believed was appealing to the broad public in the United States. But at the same time, he did it in a way that suggested that he's open to dialogue, that he respects those with whom he disagrees. And I thought the contrast with Sarah Huckabee Sanders was really interesting. She tried to persuade us that Joe Biden was himself an extremist. She talked about crazy. She kind of said it may not be him, but the woke mob has taken over the White House. And, you know, I think, again, Biden wants to say, look, on the issues, we have real disagreements. Here's where I stand, et cetera. And again, I think in many cases, you know, our polling shows the common ground is not always right in the center. And on a lot of these issues, he's articulating a quite popular position. But he wants to show that he's also willing to work with the other side so that stylistically the public doesn't have to swallow the idea of somebody who just wants to battle. And I think he sort of pulled that off, a degree of feistiness, but it was sort of feistiness on behalf of the people, but a willingness to say, hey, we may disagree, but let's sit at a table and try to work things out.
Yeah, and we're going to play that Huckabee Sanders woke mob clip in just a minute. As part of another specific policy contrast, really, or maybe culture war contrast between Biden and her. But Aaron, before we do that, anything from you on that little play at the start, kind of, I think, tweaking the more radical Republicans by congratulating McCarthy, saying he looks forward to working with him and he hopes that doesn't ruin his reputation?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think happy warrior probably is a correct description of kind of the president's mood last night. But at the same time, he still is communicating what got him even into the race for president in the beginning. And that is that he is in a battle for the soul of America. And that means, you know, that he is extending this kind of message of unity and bipartisanship. But, you know, not unlike the substance of the tone that he struck in Philadelphia, where he said, you know, we will not work with, you know, radical Republican extremists, you know, that he sees as people that he won't be able to work with. He wants to work with Republicans that he thinks that he can, but he understands that maybe there may be some Republicans that he can't. He was mixing it up with some of those folks from the floor of the House last night, but also continued to kind of say, you know, for those of you who do want to work with us, we are willing to do that. I'm thinking of other kind of moments where he made similar quips, whether it was, you know, telling Republicans who either support infrastructure or are happy to see it come to their districts, you know, see you at the groundbreaking is what he said, you know, to some laughs, or when he kind of chatted, I don't know which lawmaker he was speaking to, but, you know, brought up the quote from his football coach from high school who said, you know, good luck with your senior year, you know, to folks who you know, were attempting to challenge him. And don't forget, there were several issues. I mean, whether we're talking about
which means what, by the way? I was wondering about that line, that good luck with your senior year, meaning they're going to get voted out of office. Was that the implication?
I think yeah, it was kind of left open to interpretation, but it was like basically, you know, good luck with that. But also, you know, him continuing to say more than once during that speech, you know, I will veto this if you all attempt to, you know, pass a federal ban on abortion or attempt to make cuts to Medicare or take away Social Security. It's not going to happen, right?
Yeah. And on that reference to his football coach, listener tweets, the State of the Union camera coverage is starting to be like sports now. When the president said ban assault weapons, the camera focused in on that gun nut, Lauren Boebert. So that's one listener's observation. And Aaron, I see that you retweeted this from your colleague Kate Sosin from the 19th. The tweet was, what many people may not realize is that LGBTQ people are at the center of all the issues Biden spoke about throughout his address. We also need to reimagine and continue to build our democracy so that fewer of us are left behind, wrote Kate Sosin in her article. So here's a moment from the speech where Biden addresses LGBTQ concerns explicitly, and it comes after what you just referenced, Aaron, his reference, and it was his only reference, to abortion rights and the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, in which he said he would veto any national ban on abortions if Congress sent him one.
It's also passed the Bipartisan Equality Act to ensure LGBTQ Americans, especially transgender young people, can live with safety and dignity.
Notable, perhaps, that he did say the word transgender and the phrase transgender young people out loud there. And again, I'm going to contrast this with the Republican response. Here again is Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders taking two explicit shots at even the existence of transgender identity. Here's the first one.
I'm the first woman to lead my state, and he's the first man to surrender his presidency to a woke mob that can't even tell you what a woman is.
And here's the second one.
Upon taking office just a few weeks ago, I signed executive orders to ban CRT, racism, and indoctrination in our schools. Eliminate the use of derogatory term Latinx in our government.
So, Aaron, maybe I shouldn't be surprised by now, but those lines blew my mind last night. She said she signed an executive order to ban racism, but the only racism she named was what she must see as racism against white people, CRT, and she called out the word Latinx there, and the only reason I could think of that she would have done that is because, different from Latino or Latina, Latinx is a gender-neutral word. How did you hear all that from Biden and from her?
Well, I think what we know is that you have Republicans who are already trying to create kind of a climate that very much features the culture wars headed into 2024, coming out of 2022, even though, you know, leaning into the culture wars had really mixed results from the midterm election. But we know that it is still pretty potent and can be effective in close races. And so you see her certainly leaning into that, and her response to what the president had to say, not really much in terms of policy priorities or what that agenda might look like from Republicans, but very much focused on the culture wars. For President Biden's part, yes, you know, Kate has written for us a lot about really the anti-LGBTQ legislation that has been sweeping states across the country at the 19th. This is something that we have been very focused on because it does feel existential for a lot of folks in the LGBTQ, particularly in the trans community. And so they have been focused on that coverage. Orion Rumler, another one of our reporters, has also been focused a lot on this coverage and what it means for them as Americans, as voters, right, who are trying to really push back against legislation that is having an impact on their daily lives. And so, you know, for folks like that, for folks who are contemplating the post-Dobbs landscape 6 months after that consequential decision, to hear the president mention abortion, to mention transgender youth, is not unimportant, but doesn't really go far enough given the climate that the country now finds itself in for folks who are concerned about these issues. So many folks who I saw online kind of reacting to those moments felt like, you know, he didn't go far enough or it didn't feel like enough of a priority in the speech. It kind of came up in like this lightning round where he's you know, going down the list of things that are on the agenda, but didn't feel like as much of a priority as, say, the issue of police violence, right, and the need for police reform, which he talked about kind of at length and really singled out Tyre Nichols' family that was in the gallery with the First Lady and really personalizing that issue for several moments before and moving on. Didn't really see the same level of attention.
We'll play a clip from that part of the speech shortly. Andrew, to what Aaron was just saying, you told us before the speech that you'd be watching, among other things, for how much does Biden address the concerns of key Democratic constituencies versus appeal as broadly as possible. Does the Biden clip we just heard, never mind the Huckabee Sanders portions, create a tension for you on that count? You heard Aaron reflecting the disappointment a lot of people in the abortion rights and LGBTQ constituencies that he didn't dwell enough or get specific enough.
Well, I think so. If I might start with the point about Latinx, because I think it kind of leads into this conversation. I heard that a little bit differently, Sarah Huckabee Sanders' use of that, than you did, Brian, in that I thought the reason she was focusing on that. So I've seen a bunch of survey evidence suggesting that people who are intended to be described by that term, that is to say Latinos and Latinas, in general don't actually like the term Latinx, that the evidence is that sort of more educated progressives, many of whom are white, use that term, but most people who it's supposed to characterize don't choose it over the terms Latino and Latina. And I think that the intention from Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the right more generally is to find these kind of wedge issues that where Democrats look like they're pandering to a constituency. I mean, this is the construction they're seeking to create that doesn't really appeal to the broad public, and it's supposed to emphasize how out of touch Democratic leadership is. And obviously, there's been a very strong attempt that's been fairly successful to increase support among Republicans or for Republicans among Latino voters. So I think there's a sense that, hey, if we can persuade ordinary Latinos and Latinas that the Democratic Party is focused on these issues that aren't really related to your life and they don't understand your identity, that there's an opportunity actually to build some support there. And I think, you know, that is the line that Biden has been walking, that he does need. I mean, I think it was pretty clear that a lot of these kind of core Democratic constituency issues came very late in the speech, that the core of the speech was focused on bread and butter economic issues that were intended to be kind of common ground, base broadening focus areas rather than abortion rights, transgender rights, et cetera. And so I think, like, it makes sense to me that people would have felt like, hey, those issues got pushed to one side. I think Biden, you know, when he ran in 2020, everybody during the primaries, lots of commentators thought, oh, he's not doing enough to appeal to base Democratic voters. And he was kind of consistently outflanked on the left. And it was clear he chose that strategy, and it obviously proved successful. And a general election strategy that was successful was built right from it. So I think he's pursuing that same approach. He's showing respect to kind of core base Democratic voters, but he wants to be very clear that the things that are primary on his mind are things that are affecting the pocketbooks of all Americans. And again, I think the attempt by Republicans will be to say that Democrats are focused on this other set of issues that isn't related to your real lives. I don't know that it'll be that successful, because I think, again, Biden has been quite strong at convincing Americans that he is thinking about the things that matter to them.
Erin, you want to keep going on that, including anything that Andrew just said, and also Huckabee Sanders' description of Latinx as a derogatory word?
Well, I do certainly, to Andrew's point, think that there are folks in the Latino community, which is not a monolith, but there is, there are cultural differences and generational differences as it pertains to that term. But, you know, again, I think, you know, for that to be kind of Governor Huckabee Sanders' first order of business really just kind of reflects that there are Republicans who are focused on the culture wars as a strategy, as a political playbook strategy headed into 2024. I mean, this is somebody who certainly is being looked at as a rising star in the Democratic Party. First woman governor of Arkansas, youngest governor in the country, and yet still kind of is espousing a lot of these same priorities that you see among people who are being discussed as possible presidential contenders, as well as obviously the former president who has announced his intent to run for president again. I think for the president, who, you know, we're assuming is running for re-election, we're expecting an announcement to be imminent that he will run for re-election. It really is about him pulling together this coalition, right? And so I do think that is why you saw him talking about at the top of the speech, you know, these issues of the economy and healthcare and infrastructure, really those things that we know that all Americans really care about and that are top of mind for them as these kind of kitchen table issues. But also, you know, being able to think about issues of reproductive rights access or LGBTQ rights as kitchen table issues for those people, for their families as well, I think was something that he gave a nod to that maybe was appreciated and something that, especially the word abortion, frankly, was something that people concerned about that issue had not heard from him out of his own mouth. And so I think that mattered, and there were a lot of folks that were feeling seen, and so you had folks like the previous caller Stephen and Kenny really saying that his performance was what they were wanting, and I think that is they are among the folks who are exactly the kind of audience that the president was speaking to last night and is hoping to appeal to and shore up as he heads into his reelection bid.
So I wonder if any of this runs along generational lines. Millennial callers, Gen Z callers, what did you think? Did you feel as much as some of the older people who might be Biden's base that he was talking to you, that he was addressing your concerns enough, that he was hitting the right notes? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, among everyone else who's also welcome to call in. And I think Stephen in Cambria Heights wants in on this piece of conversation we were just having. Stephen, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And unfortunately, I'm sorry, I'm not Generation X.
No, that's all right. It doesn't matter. That's for later.
I guess, and I'll make it quick. I was looking, I guess what really got me was the comparison. I mean, when I watched Biden, I thought he had a great speech. I thought he did well. On the other hand, I watched Huckabee, and I got this. You talked about the worst administration, yet there's no mention of the administration she was involved in. She talked about going to the war zone with former president and how they loved him so much. And all I kept thinking, well, Roosevelt and Truman and LBJ and Nixon all went to war zones, and W was also had went there, and you know, and troops do, you are encouraged as a troop, as members of the troop, to, you know, your president. You can't really criticize
him. Commander in chief when he shows up.
Thank
at the
you.
Front,
also,
right?
When she talked about the young Republicans, and I kept thinking, you know, work with them, and I'm thinking, well, Taylor Greene, Getz, and Holland, all being controlled supposedly by Kevin McCarthy, a man who half the time ain't got the backbone of Charlie McCarthy. You're telling me to, you know, that this is your party, and whether you need to talk about it. If you know, and you talk about the CRT, and you want to talk about, well, blacks and everyone are doing great. Well, I'm black. Well, great, blacks are doing great in this country and this and that. But you don't want to talk about the history of what we came through. You need, there's nothing wrong with young white children learning what my father did in World War II, and learning also about men like Mel Brooks, who was Jewish, and what he went through in his basic training in the South during World War II.
Thank you, Stephen. And by
wouldn't
referencing,
hurt your children to know that.
By referencing Charlie McCarthy, you definitely showed your age.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Call us again. Look it up, folks, Charlie McCarthy. And kind of to put a pin in what Stephen was just saying, listener tweets that when Sarah Huckabee Sanders spoke about her trip with the president to visit the troops in Iraq and she talked about how the troops reacted, she never mentioned that president's name. We'll continue in a minute with excerpts from and your reactions to State of the Union Night. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with excerpts from and your reactions to State of the Union Night, and with our guests, Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large at the news organization The 19th, and Andrew Seligson, president of the nonpartisan research and public engagement organization Public Agenda. Let's get to the feisty Biden that everybody's talking about. He was feisty, and on the Biden feisty track, here's the clip, and I didn't want to lead with it because everybody's been playing it, but this is the one I'm seeing replayed the most, and it is worthy of attention, in which he seems to goad the Republicans, this is to my eye anyway what happened, he seemed to goad the Republicans into booing him, and then he has his response to that ready to engage with. It comes at the end of a section on making the wealthy pay their fair share in taxes, which he segues into the topic of Social Security and Medicare.
Instead of making the wealthy pay their fair share, some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset. I'm not saying it's a majority. Let me give you, anybody who doubts it, contact my office. I'll give you a copy of the proposal.
So, Andrew, that was political theater like nothing I remember seeing at the State of the Union address. That's why it's getting so much attention, I guess. A lot of people don't remember seeing anything like that. Did it also look to you like Biden set that whole thing up so he could look good and high energy and kind of get the Republicans on the record about not cutting Social Security and Medicare? Maybe he was leaning into a bipartisan priority and drawing a distinction between the parties at the same time there.
Yeah, it was a little hard to say whether he got kind of lucky and improvised well or whether it was scripted. And, you know, I think for folks who, you know, there is this plan from, I'm pretty sure, from Rick Scott that has language that can at least be interpreted as indicating that he would sunset Social Security and Medicare. It has not, you know, gotten broad support among Republicans, et cetera. So I think it certainly was calculated to seem like dirty pool to the Republicans. Which, you know, as he said, he kind of had a technical defense for. But I definitely think, yes, the opportunity to kind of show that he's ready to mix it up in defense of those very popular programs that so many people, including so many seniors, rely on. And, you know, that certainly worked well for him. And yeah, I think it is absolutely the kind of like the you know, that mix of things we were discussing, that there's a readiness to kind of stand and fight for the American people. That's part of what he's presenting. But also, right, you know, looking for the common ground. And as he said, you know, the fact that he was able to wrap it up by saying, hey, if it looks like we've come to some agreement here, that's terrific. And, you know, it kind of allowed him to stand tough on the issue. It's obviously a Democratic priority to protect those programs. And I think he's partly teeing up the battle that is about to come over the debt ceiling, as, you know, those entitlement programs are likely to be part of that story. So I think he wants to kind of, the better he can do at setting up Republicans, you know, for being on record that they want to protect those programs, the better position he is going into that. But yeah, I think that sort of balance that he's constantly seeking to strike between toughness, readiness to fight on the issues that matter to people, but also a willingness to come to agreement, it kind of all came together there because he had that smiling, laughing kind of approach to it, which just made him seem like a pretty relatable person.
Right. And whether he set the whole thing up or, as you speculate, maybe just ad-libbed well when he got that response from the Republicans, either way, it makes him look on it. And not over the hill. Peter in Great Neck wants in on this portion of the conversation. Peter, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I do not watch State of the Unions, first of all. I the next day, I listen to NPR, read the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, etc. This part of his speech really gets to me and aggravates me because everyone knows what it is going to take to fix Social Security and set it up for the long term. And this type of sloganeering and using the State of the Union to demonize the other side, to me, strikes me as one of the most craven things that a president can do in a State of the Union. And I'm Gen X. I personally, you know, I look forward to collecting Social Security. I've paid into it all my life. And I also know that some things that have to be done might include raising taxes, might include adjusting the benefits, and might include raising the retirement age. But this idea that Republicans want to cut Social Security or sunset it, that is really just, if it's at worst, it's lying, and it best, it's misdirection. And that, to someone who knows what the facts are, is really frustrating.
Yeah. The word sunset comes from that proposal, maybe you know this, by Republican Senator Rick Scott.
Every 5 years,
of Florida.
Rick Scott says yes. Right. Republican puts a proposal together, and it gets demonized by the other side. We've been seeing this kabuki act for so long that if somebody has an idea to fix Social Security, whether it's George Bush or Rick Scott, and it has some kind of sense, it gets twisted and demonized by the Democrats into something that it's not. It's really aggravating for somebody who's, you know, 10 years away from retirement.
Peter, thank you. We appreciate your call. Thank you. Call us again. And speaking of seniors, here's another kind of senior, Luke in Westchester, who is a senior in high school. Hi, Luke. You're on WNYC. Thanks for calling in today.
Hi. Thank you so much, Brian. What is it called? I was actually watching the State of the Union with my friends last night. We were in AP Gov class, and we had to fill out a sheet while we were watching and we were analyzing it. And I actually thought that Biden was very enthusiastic, and I kind of disagree with the previous caller. I thought that Biden calling out the specific Republican, not specific, but calling out the Republicans who have voiced some, not exactly opposition, but just some thoughts that aren't exactly 100% in favor of Social Security. I think that that's actually something that invigorates the party. And also, at the end, what I thought he did was smart was that he reached out and he said, call my office, be bipartisan. I thought that was a good strategy.
Mm-hmm. You like that. Did last night change your impression of Biden in any way from what you may have had before?
I mean, I've been pretty enthusiastic about Biden. I supported him in 2020, and obviously I couldn't vote, but I supported him, and I plan to, in 2024, if he's a nominee, vote for him again. Vote for him very enthusiastically.
Yeah. Well, I hope you get extra credit for calling the show in your AP government class.
And thank you so much.
Lou, call us again. Kathleen in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. As I was telling the screener, I'm a young millennial, old Gen Z, depending on how you draw that line. And you asked if people of my demographic felt like he was talking to us, and I mm-hmm. personally didn't, but I wasn't surprised by that. I expect pretty middle-of-the-road stances from Joe Biden, and especially given the mess that is the House Republican caucus, I expect, and just the sort of state of division generally in partisan politics, I expected him to do the sort of appealing to the broadest possible base, talking about things like jobs and inflation and infrastructure that he thinks are going to appeal to as many people as possible. And so while certainly he said a couple of things that upset Republicans, he also stopped at one point because he was surprised by how many people were standing in the chamber applauding when he said something excessively moderate. And I wasn't surprised by that at all, because that's what I expect from him.
What could he have said that would have made you feel more like he was talking to you?
That's a good question. I think partially I don't expect him to be talking to me. I expect that from more left-leaning members of the party, and especially younger members of the party who just tend to speak to issues that more directly affect me. Mm-hmm. I appreciated that he talked about climate change. That's something that I, think is important for my generation. And he did talk about education, but he didn't talk about student debt. I think there are just issues that more progressive members of the Democratic Party, who also tend to be younger, are more inclined to talk about. And those are some strong examples, climate change and student debt, and doing something radical about those issues, whereas he was trying to keep his comments on those things as neutral and moderate as possible.
Great, Kathleen. Thank you. Thank you very much. Call us again, please. All right, one more clip. And Aaron, I see that your article on the 19th site this morning is about Tyree Nichols' parents being at the State of the Union address. Looks like you interviewed his mom, Rovon Wells, and Biden referenced how, as a white father, he never had to have the talk with his own kids about how to act when you encounter the police. Then he said this, which you highlighted in your piece.
It's up to us. All of us. We all want the same thing. Neighborhoods free of violence. Law enforcement who earns the community's trust. Just as every cop, when they pin on that badge in the morning, has a right to be able to go home at night, so does everybody else out there. Our children have a right to come home safely.
How did that strike you, Aaron? How did you contextualize it in your reporting today?
Well, it was striking, Brian, because Rovon Wells, her husband Rodney, they are, to my mind, and I've been covering the Black Lives Matter movement for the better part of a decade, the first time that you've seen parents of a Black American killed by law enforcement in the First Lady's box at a State of the Union address, right? So that kind of signals the priority that the administration is putting on this issue. You had several family members of Black families affected by this issue who were also in the House gallery at the invitation of Black lawmakers who are continuing to push for federal police reform legislation and really putting a face on this issue, making it more human. That is certainly something that Rovon Wells told me that she was hoping her presence would bring to the speech and to this issue as federal police reform legislation continues to stall in Congress. We know that the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act didn't pass last summer, got stalled out in the Senate. And so these families are really hoping that, you know, the tragic death of Tyre Nichols is going to be something that can help to create momentum for this issue yet again, as we have seen in past years with mass shooting incidents and folks trying to push for gun violence, action around gun violence, which we did see as able to happen last year in Congress. And so seeing these families, seeing Rovan Wells, you know, without even having to hear from that family at all, but for the president to address them and to talk about their son and to talk about this issue in a way that says that he sees them and that this is something that he cares about and that the American people should be working together to address, even while praising law enforcement that he does have respect for when they are doing the right thing, but also wanting to hold bad actors accountable. That was really something that felt remarkable for a State of the Union and something that has not happened.
Yeah, and good that they were there, but also really sadly another example of what you called in your piece having to grieve in public for Tyre's parents. Andrew, last word from you. With your interest in bipartisanship and identifying areas of common ground, did the president, and we've had so much interesting conversation between you two and the callers on what was too much centrism, not enough addressing particular issues, or hitting a sweet spot for actually getting things done. Do you think this sets him up in any way with a Republican Congress to get some bipartisan legislation passed this year?
I think that is, well, it's a tough question. I'm immediately having trouble even forming a sentence because I think, you know, as I think Aaron referred to earlier, there's Kevin McCarthy, but there's also the wing of the Republican Party that made it so hard for Kevin McCarthy to even just win the speaker election. And I think, you know, it seems unlikely that the president would be able to peel away Republicans given people's fears about getting primaried, the fact that so many folks are running in districts where that's where the game is, not the general election. You know, just the mathematics of it make it hard to break up that party. And it's hard to imagine that the Lauren Boberts and Matt Gaetz's and Marjorie Taylor Greens are ready to start compromising or looking for common ground issues. So I'm not sure that, you know, I think part of what he's doing is a 2024 strategy about saying, yeah, we were blocked from doing the things we wanted to do, but you understand what I was trying to do, which is take care of the bread and butter issues facing the American public. Obviously, that's what he spent a huge amount of the speech on, manufacturing jobs, accomplishments already through the infrastructure bill and the sort of get, you know, finish the job routine. So I think I don't expect to see a ton of bipartisanship in the way the Congress works. But I think Biden wants to go into 2024 with the public thinking of him as the one who was seeking to be reasonable and Republicans refusing to compromise.
Andrew Seligson from Public Agenda, Aaron Haynes from the 19th. Thank you both so much for getting up and doing this with us this morning after I'm sure you were up late last night digesting the two speeches. Thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Go Birds this Sunday.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. I did not expect a football reference to get in there at the end. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.